You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Tonight we have the episode that I promised you guys a little while back. We have Shane Metlin, formerly of FanRag Sports, joining us. For those of you that haven't caught it yet, last weekend when the news of the Sylvia DeSouza suspension first came down, I actually got in touch with Shane. He had made a brief mention on Twitter about an article that he had written talking about some bias that seemed to be apparent from the NCAA clearinghouse. I was able to get that article, and with his permission, we reposted it over on Rock Chalk Talk. I do recommend, if you haven't already, go ahead and go read that. But we do talk about it somewhat here in this episode. So I will get you guys right on over to that episode there. And then when we come back, I'll do our normal recap and looking ahead to the weekend coming up. So I will get you right on over. We're going to go ahead and take a quick break to get some commercials in, and then I will get you right on over there. And I'm joined now by Shane Metlin. He formerly of FanRag Sports, but currently with DNR Sports. Shane, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty well. How about you?
I'm doing pretty good. So obviously the connection here isn't really apparent immediately, but kind of a little bit of background of why we have you on the podcast tonight. You sent out a pretty interesting tweet in the wake of the Sylvia DeSouza news, talking about some reporting you had previously done dealing with a pattern of rulings, involving African athletes done by the NCAA. So first of all, my big question for you is, what was it that got you started down that line of reporting?
Well, actually, I guess it was about, three and a half years ago, whenever the Cheick Diallo case and Taco Fall were happening about the same time with the NCAA, basically just holding them out and not giving a ruling. And then both those schools, Central Florida and Kansas, I think started getting their lawyers involved and things sped along. That was when I wrote a column, like basically it's an opinion piece, kind of questioning why this seems to happen repeatedly to players who come from Africa, because I live in Virginia. I was working in the Charlottesville, Virginia area at the time. Mm-hmm. And so I knew from the story I wrote, the Sarah Movio case, a women's player who went through a similar thing where she was ruled ineligible coming out of high school. And I just happened to know that she was an outstanding student, went to a school that, was a really good college preparatory school, was going to play women's basketball at Virginia, not a place where you're expecting, them to be like, a bunch of shenanigans to try to get somebody eligible. We're not talking about, Alabama football or something like that. I mean, it was just like the fact that she was ruled ineligible was completely shocking. And I'd always kind of taken note then from then on when an African student went through something similar. It was just happening repeatedly. And so I wrote this column kind of like just posing the question, is there a reason for this? Why is it? And then shortly after that, I actually heard from Paul Hewitt, who, a lot of KU fans will remember, right, coach of Georgia Tech, and he had been at George Mason recently at that point. And he told me, you are onto something, that there's really something here. But we had this case with this guy, and he told me all the details about a player he had failed to be able to get eligible, who came from Gabon. And even beyond that, he, told me, and, this is what we talk about at the, NABC meetings, the National Association of Basketball Coaches, or he had been president. Bill Self, I think, may have been president at the time. So they were close, and they had discussed this, and he, you know, told me to call Tony Bennett at Virginia, who had gone through something similar. And they would tell me to call other coaches, and I just started hearing that this is something that coaches had been talking about. It's something administrators had been trying to figure out. Lawyers had been involved kind of all over the country. And that there was just something to it, whether it was, you know, intentional bias, just, maybe there was an explanation about why it seemed to happen over and over again. Maybe there's a good reason for it, but the NCAA won't really answer any questions about it. So it just kind of became a thing. And like I said, a lot of people don't want to talk on the record about it because, you know, they worry about, you know, ticking off the NCAA. But I would hear from coaches who would say, yeah, and, oh, you really ought to call Mississippi State because they're dealing with the same thing with one of their players. And like, or you ought to call this place or check out this high school. And it just kind of snowballed from there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reading through, or I read through this entire thing before I went ahead and posted it, because we did go ahead and repost it for you on Rock Chalk Talk. Obviously, you originally wrote it for FanRag Sports, which is no longer operating at this point. And I did everything I could to try to find, you know, even looking at like the Wayback Machine to see if we could get the original, you know, as it was originally posted. But we went ahead and reposted it on Rock Chalk Talk. And it's just, I mean, it's incredible all the different examples that you go through. I think what I'm curious though is, which do you think was the most shocking story that you heard, whether it's in the article or even if it was something that you got on background that you weren't able to put in the article?
The Terrence Mayemba story from George Mason, just the more details I got on that was the one that was pretty shocking. That was shocking, and just that it seemed like someone at the NCAA decided this kid should not be eligible for whatever reason. And then whatever evidence they continued to bring up to say that, oh, actually, you know, we have an answer for that, that they just decided they were not going to make him eligible no matter what George Mason came up with. So that was very shocking in that regard. That was the one that made it seem like there was something more than just, you know, this is bureaucratic, or this is like, these are the rules, even if the rules don't really make sense in this situation. Really just knowing like how many players, you know, especially like on the women's side, where we're not talking about big money necessarily or like big time programs and things like that. Like people who were just outstanding students who were ruled academically ineligible because they couldn't pull up their middle school transcripts. And I mean, I went through the NCAA clearinghouse, this was 20 years ago, but I went through it and never for a second had to like go back to middle school or, I mean, it was basically like, oh, you got a good GPA, you passed your test. Okay, great.
Yeah, you know, I'm wondering too, though, in terms of just the time frame, how prevalent it was for international students to come over and try to get, especially the high profile programs. I mean, that may have something to do with them, you know, continuing to kind of evolve their standards. But, you know, it seems, and one of our commenters on our site had made mention of this when he read the article today, you know, and said that it seems like the NCAA set up the system to be really easy to go through if you're a U.S. student, because it's not really hard to find middle school transcripts if you live in the U.S. But for a lot of these players that come from, you know, especially African nations, but even some of the European ones, like it's not necessarily really simple to get records from that far back. And so they're already at a disadvantage having to come up with all this information. But it seems like it's kind of nitpicking anyway, making them go all the way back to sixth grade, considering, you know, high school associations don't even require you to have credits from sixth through eighth grade in order to graduate in most cases.
Yeah, I don't know that they're asking like players from the United States or Canada or wherever to like provide their middle school transcripts. I think it seems to be if you came, a lot of these kids went to school in the United States for 3 or 2 years, and it seems like maybe if they weren't having a full high school career in the United States, that's when they wanted to like have some sort of verification
right
from middle school. But like, you know, in one case there was no middle school transcript because the schools in Kenya were on strike for a semester, like 6 months. So there was no transcript from that year.
Yeah.
And it was just sort of like insane, the level that they were making people go through. You know, there was a case from UC Irvine where they, the coach there went back to, I think it was Senegal. And I mean, I think he was like, there were times where he sort of feared for his safety, like trying to find these records, people kind of wondering why he was like trying to dig for records in Senegal. But, you know, that was what he had to do to get his player eligible.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of crazy that they're requiring so much documentation, especially from people where it's not likely they're actually going to have the documentation anyway. But like, you know, I was reading through specifically the Mayemba case that you were talking about, how, you know, at first they asked for records from Gabon and it was really hard to get the information because everything was handwritten. It wasn't electronic. So then when they finally were able to get the information, they decided, oh, wait a minute, this is academic fraud because there's no way you could have actually gotten this information correctly. But they were able to get cleared from that, and then they moved on to the next thing, which is an amateurism case, which, according, I mean, based off the information that you have here in the article, you know, they were able to get past that, and then they tried to make a big deal about his age, which I'm not even understanding, like, why that was an issue in the first place.
Because, the opinion of the people who were involved, especially on the George Mason end, is that somebody at the NCAA decided that this kid should not be eligible, and then they did their reasons to fit, like, whatever it took to make that decision. And that's where it, like, sort of becomes sort of, like, more questionable about the motives of some people, especially when there were some people involved who had, you know, made some posts on Twitter and things that at the very least offended people. Whether, you know, that's where it gets hard for me to talk about people's intentions too, is because nobody from the NCAA would talk.
Right.
And
you have
tried
to
over
you
and
have
over
to,
again.
Right. You kind of have to guess at what the intentions seem to be based off of the actions when they're not allowed to defend or when they're not able to defend themselves. You know, it is kind of a leap to assume that that's the intention that they had, but it also is a little concerning when there's so much, you know, evidence of all the actions that they took. It's hard to get.
Yeah, I would be glad to have somebody defend themselves to me and explain it. But when they won't do that, and then, you know, it's easy to understand why people would take things the way they did, given things that happened and the people involved and all of that.
Yeah, I guess what I'm also, why I'm just really still baffled by that, honestly, is because, you know, it says that they were trying to say he was 20 when he went to go enroll, but I don't understand why that would prevent him, you know, from enrolling. Like, maybe he doesn't have all the eligibility, but we hear stories all the time about people that are, you know, 60 something that are walking on for low level basketball teams because they never actually use any college eligibility. They never went to college. So I'm a little puzzled.
I'm not entirely sure why that mattered in his case, but that was the way the NCAA ruled, which I think is.
Yeah.
Frustrates people so much is that there's so much inconsistency.
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, obviously, you know, this tied into Kansas back when we were talking about the Cheick Diallo case as well. You know, and I mean, there was a little bit, well, now that I'm actually diving back to what the Diallo case was, that was a clearinghouse issue in terms of whether he was actually eligible. I think there was also an amateurism case there that they tried to make as well when he ended up sitting out for like 7 games or something like that. I don't know that anything's really changed though in this case. I mean, we haven't had as many high profile type of cases, especially involving African students that I can think of that come to mind, but there always seems to be some sort of controversial, you know, case concerning the eligibility center and all of that. What was it though, when you heard the news about Sylvia De Souza, that immediately made you connect that to this story that you wrote?
The severity of the penalty. I mean, it just didn't seem consistent with what's gone on in the NCAA before. You know, even in Kansas, you know, these kinds of things typically have been, okay, 5 to 10 game suspension, pay the money back and move on. And
right, there's been plenty of examples of that.
Sort of been the standard that's like set for this. And then to see somebody that's, you know, number one, you know, to see that, see it be much, so much more harsh in that regard. And then also there's been three players tied to this FBI investigation, to the trial now, who have been ruled on by the NCAA. And the penalty, the severity of the penalty is inverse to the amount of money allegedly involved, which makes no sense. Like, Sylvia D'Souza, we're talking about the least amount of money of the three players with Sylvia D'Souza, and by far the harshest penalty, which sort of like set off the, you know, lights to me. It's another thing that's like, it's just another instance where like, what's the difference here in this case, in this case? Well, it's a kid that came from Africa.
Right.
And, you know, you'd like the NCAA to like explain things, but they just refuse to do so.
I think some might argue that it has less to do with the fact that he's from Africa and more to do with the fact that KU's like the high profile school in the whole Adidas thing. And that maybe they're trying to use him as a way to hammer Kansas.
It certainly could be.
But even, you know, then it leads itself to, you know, why are they so willing to use a kid from Africa to be the hammer against another school? You know, they could have done similar sorts of things to like Miami. You know, they've supposedly there was Miami coach involvement as well, you know, in what was going on with him. So, you know, I do agree that there seems to be something here, even if it's not a, you know, we want to go out and have a harsh penalty against this guy because he's from Africa. It's a, well, we don't necessarily care as much. Because look, you know, this kid from Africa came over and he's still going to get to go to school and all of this other stuff. I mean, I don't know that I personally can make the leap that they wanted to screw over a kid from Africa, but it definitely seems to indicate that they don't necessarily have any qualms about actually doing it if that's what happens in that case.
Yeah. I'm kind of on the same page as you, and you know, like, it's really hard for me to say like, oh yeah, people were out to get African students, but I can also see why so many people were angry about that and felt like that. You know, if you're Paul Hewitt or, you know, Terrence Mayemba, and you were ruled permanently ineligible, like, I can see why you feel like you were, like, they were out to get you for one reason or another.
Right. So I guess really the question here becomes, and actually what actually just dropped probably about an hour ago, was additional details that the NCAA essentially said that they weren't even going to rule in his case until Kansas declared him to be ineligible in the first place, and then agreed that TJ Gasignola, the guy from Adidas, was officially a booster of Kansas, which I'm guessing was them essentially trying to extort the situation with D'Souza so that they could then levy huge penalties against Kansas for lack of institutional control, all that kind of stuff. So again, that kind of seems to lend more credence to the theory that essentially they're using D'Souza as a pawn, as a way to try to get a bigger, you know, penalty against Kansas. And whether it's justified or not, it seems kind of despicable for the NCAA to feel like they have the ability to go ahead and do that and hold a guy's career hostage. You know, maybe
yeah,
because they have a beef with the school.
It makes you sort of wonder if it's not so much, you know, really caring about whether or not somebody's from Africa or not, but one thing about the majority of these kids is their parents are not here to help them through this. And they're not here to, you know, be involved in the legal process and things like that. And it sort of makes you wonder if, like, well, they think like, okay, well, we can do this now and it's not going to be as big a deal and we're not going to hear as much about it and things like that.
And in a way, it almost weakens their position, though, because now what we're hearing a lot about is, you know, oh, Sylvia D'Souza was taken advantage of by a guardian who he has no relation to, who, you know, he came over, had to be sponsored by somebody to be able to go to school here in the U.S., you know, and this guardian who has no relation to him is taking advantage of him. Whereas if it was a case where the parent was here and the parent was the one taking the money, then you can say that, oh, well, this guy probably benefited from it because, you know, even if he personally didn't receive the money, I'm sure his parents are helping him somehow and he's going to get some sort of benefit from it. A guardian like that,
yeah.
The public opinion, I mean, I think everybody nationally has pilloried the NCAA today because, you know, a guy who has absolutely no relation to him is taking advantage of him, getting whatever money that he gets, assuming all of the allegations are actually true, because honestly, at this point, I don't know that we can trust that what the NCAA is saying happened actually happened. It's all based off of the testimony of one guy in court who got a deal with the federal government to try to help the government make their case. So, I guess really my main question though, moving forward, because you talked in here about there was a lot of coaches and individuals in the system that aren't willing to come forward because they were afraid of, you know, ramifications from the NCAA. How much does this and, you know, like the previous instances of Missouri being cooperative with the Committee of Infractions and getting absolutely hammered, like how much does the public sentiment against the NCAA now make that less likely that they're going to stay silent in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. There's still, I mean, it seems to me like it's a situation where the NCAA is so impotent in a lot of ways about their ability to be able to enforce things that when they do have an opportunity to, they, you know, really put the hammer down. You know, we've seen it with, you know, with North Carolina and, you know, relenting on the Penn State thing and stuff like that, that, you know, they've been kind of backed into a corner before. And when they get to the opportunity to look tough, they try to. But like you said, I think the public sentiment is going the other way. It makes you wonder if they're going to start trying to, you know, deal with things differently with, for whatever reason they have for making the decisions they do. People are certainly acknowledging and reacting to the fact that there's really no consistency to how they handle things. You know, you can go back. I mean, we talk about like something the KU fans will, you know, be tied to. Two of the coaches that have gotten hit the hardest in the last, you know, 30, 35 years have been Larry Brown and Rick Majerus,
right,
for relatively minor violations. And the reason the NCAA hit them so hard is because they didn't just apologize and say, I'm sorry, it won't happen again, we're doing better. They said, no, this is a stupid rule. I'm not sorry that I gave the kid a jacket. I'm not sorry I gave the kid lunch when he was going to his father's funeral. And they didn't apologize for that, and they got hammered. Whereas, you know, most schools just went through the process of saying, you know, like, oh, yep, we committed a violation, we're sorry, maybe we should take a scholarship away and just move on. And they're like, okay.
Yeah, and well, I mean, I think what we're seeing now different, you know, the NCAA got completely blasted over the whole Adidas trial thing. You know, people talking about, well, I mean, they got tons of bad press about how this whole FBI investigation was really related to the fact that they have amateurism rules that nobody thinks are actually, you know, worth the trouble anymore, essentially. And so they got a lot of bad press for it. And I think now they're at the point now where they're going to do as much as they can enforcement wise to try to say, well, you know, we have these rules, we're going to enforce them, and you guys have to basically deal with it. They've swung completely the other way now. They used to get hammered all the time for being completely inconsistent. I mean, the whole, you know, the whole UNC athletic or academic, you know, issue there that ended up, they didn't make any kind of, you know, in any real substantive penalties for that because they tried to say that it was a whole school academic type of issue. You know, they basically showed and kept taking away their own power with those types of decisions. And so now I think they've swung back in the other direction, trying to reestablish some of the power that they lost by taking advantage of the fact that the Adidas trial was in the public, you know, sphere for so long that everybody kind of knows what happens. There's a bunch of people that you know that there's a bunch of quote unquote corruption going on in this type of system. Even though the reason that there is corruption is because the NCAA is taking advantage of talented athletes by not allowing them to get any kind of money to make up for, you know, what they're actually giving the NCAA. So that's a whole nother conversation, obviously, that we could have. But I guess really the only question is, you know, left at this point is, you know, is there any kind of recourse? Do you think the next step for this is that Sylvia DeSouza starts filing a lawsuit or something like that? I mean, would he potentially have any kind of case against the NCAA? In terms of damages to his potential career or anything like that?
I think it's possible. You know, I'm not enough of a legal expert
to
say that for sure, but he's got his lawyers and he's definitely got KU in his corner and, you know, a lot of people in his corner. I think it's definitely worth a try for him. And
you know, I guess really the question is that what it's going to take for the NCAA to be forced off of this, you know, increased enforcement and really hammering a bunch of kids that you know, are being taken advantage of.
It might be. We see this time and time again, though. Like, NCAA will play their hand until they overplay their hand, and then when lawyers get involved, they back off. Right. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with, you know, KU here. That's what happened with Jack Diallo. It's what happened with Taco Fall, which was how it kind of all started for me as far as, you know, getting involved in, you know, the story and the trend of it. It sort of goes back to what we were talking about before. Like, you know, it seems like they see a vulnerability in some of these kids who don't have family anywhere near them. And then thinking that there won't be much pushback. And then as soon as there is, because, you know, Kansas or Central Florida or whoever gets involved and, you know, can, you know, get lawyers involved, almost as soon as that begins, they relented in both of those cases. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with D'Souza. It might be tough to get anything done, any kind of appeal to get him back this year. But
right.
You know, I think the fact that he's suspended for next year, it gives, you know, D'Souza and KU and, you know, all the people involved there some time to, try to, you know, salvage something.
Yeah, I mean, and I almost wonder if the whole Billy Preston issue from last year, where, you know, he was all set to play, got into a car accident, and then there was questions about, you know, where he got the car from. And it mm-hmm. seems, based off all the testimony and everything that we can, you know, that can be reasonably verified, that he probably was taking money directly from people over at Adidas and was doing a whole lot more than a guy like Silvio D'Souza would have been. And that he seems to have been directly involved in that. The fact, though, that Kansas, mm-hmm. you know, self-reported this violation or potential violation, voluntarily held him out. Like, it didn't seem to buy any goodwill at all for Kansas. You know, the government made whatever case that they were able to make and made it, you know, the only way to make the case stick was essentially to say all these schools are victims. And so if we're using the information from the trial at face value, then it almost seems like the NCAA has decided, well, we only believe part of this information. We want to believe as nefarious as we can in terms of the intentions of everybody involved. And so we're going to try to penalize schools. And the fact that Kansas, you know, held out Billy Preston doesn't really do them any good in this case.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it all kind of goes back to, you know, the NCAA really having no ability to enforce their own rules. And then when something like this does happen, the overreaction and the over response to it, I guess. And, you know, if you feel, I mean, it's human nature. If you feel helpless most of the time, and then you finally get some sort of leverage, it's kind of human nature to maybe overplay your hand, but it's right. Also it can be devastating for people involved who really don't deserve it.
Yeah, it also doesn't win you any points in the court of public opinion there. So all mm-hmm. right, well, Shane, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Did you have any other final thoughts you wanted to share about this at all?
No, I think we covered a lot, but yeah, I appreciate you guys having me on.
Sounds great. Yeah. So for those that are curious, what kind of coverage are you doing right now?
Well, right now I'm a beat reporter covering James Madison University and the Colonial Athletic Association basketball here in Virginia. So got back on a college basketball beat, which I enjoy. So I was happy to do that.
Sounds good. Yeah, actually, I know quite a bit about them only because I also happen to live in Virginia right now as well. So as many people that listen to the podcast for a while know. But yeah, maybe we'll get a chance to cross paths again. Maybe Kansas will get to play, play you guys at some point in the near future. So thanks again for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
Yep. Have a good one. And that'll do it for today's episode. Thank you guys so much for listening. Again, you know, these kind of conversations, while they're not necessarily pleasant, and we wish we didn't have to talk about this kind of stuff, it is important to get that information out there to let people know about what's going on and what great investigative work has been done. You know, even if it is a few years old, it still applies in this case. It's unfortunate we're having to talk about it again now, but it's also great, you know, that especially in the world we live in today where we can get that information out to people and let people know about what's going on, and so we can hear about these stories when we need to. Just kind of recapping the action that we've had from the last few days, since the last podcast that we had. We didn't go over this on the National Signing Day episode, but I figured this was a good place to do it. On Wednesday, Let's see. We had the women's tennis team won 4-1 over Nebraska. Unfortunately, the women's basketball team lost at home to K-State 72-62. And then obviously coming up, let's see, this episode is publishing on Friday morning. So we have coming up tonight, we have the track and field team. They're at Iowa State, and they're also at Arkansas for two different meets that we have there. We also have the softball team is playing a doubleheader against Oregon and Stanford. Those games actually will probably be going on right around the time you guys are listening to this, unless you listen to it right when it drops in the morning. And then the swimming and diving team plays has a meet starting at 6 p.m. At home, welcoming Iowa State in for that. Over the weekend, you know, all those events are actually still continuing. Track and field also in New York. The NYRR Milrose Games. So the track and field team is going to be all over the place this weekend. But then we have a noon tip-off. I'm sorry, an 11 a.m. tip-off. I was looking at an Eastern time there. But an 11 a.m. tip-off at home against Oklahoma State on ESPN2 for the men's basketball team. The softball team has a game down in Tempe, Arizona at 3:30 against Arizona State. Actually, they're playing a doubleheader. At Arizona State, and then they're also playing against Utah down there as well. And then the women's basketball team at 7 p.m. on the Jayhawk Radio Network are hosting the Texas Longhorns at home. So Allen Fieldhouse will be pulling a doubleheader as well, the men's basketball in the afternoon, and then the women's basketball in the evening. And then softball will wrap up the weekend on Sunday against Missouri down in Tempe, Arizona at 11 a.m. on Sunday morning. I'm not sure if we will have another show. We're still kind of ironing out the new schedule for the new podcast channel. We are going to try to bring you more episodes more frequently, but until we get some other shows on there, it may not be every day like we're hoping to eventually get to. So there may be an episode for you guys on Monday morning before the TCU game. Kansas will be at TCU at 8 p.m. on ESPN on Monday, the 11th. We may have an episode that morning. We may not. Do guys stay tuned. We are going to drop another episode actually tomorrow morning or later tonight. I'm going to be talking with Fetch about the Kansas State game that I think we all probably want to forget about, but we'll do a quick postmortem on that. And then previewing the Oklahoma State game that we have coming up. We might get to a little bit of a preview of the TCU game as well, just kind of depending on what's going on there. So, do stay tuned for the episode that we're going to have for you a little bit later with that preview. But thank you guys so much for tuning in. Again, if you do have any questions, if you have any comments, anything you want to get to us, you can find us on Twitter at RockChalkPod. The email is RockChalkPodcast@gmail.com. Like I said on the last episode when we announced the official partnership now with the Rock Chalk Talk podcast channel, we are looking for additional input. If there's anybody out there that really wants to get into podcasting, would be interested in helping to create any new shows for the channel or anything like that, our ears are definitely open on that. If you have any suggestions, in terms of formatting or anything you guys want to listen to or anything you guys think that we need to add, we are definitely taking those sorts of suggestions. So please do reach out. If you have any questions, any comments, if you want us to talk about anything in particular on this show, definitely let me know. If you haven't already, please find us on iTunes, rate, subscribe, all that fun stuff. We really do want to get that extra visibility. The nice comments and everything really does help to get us out there so that more people can listen to the podcast. Once again, thank you guys so much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on the Rock Chalk.